We are trying to get started on Perek Ted Vav, chapter 15, but I felt like, as I said last week, the chapter really needs introduction in terms of the ethics of war within Judaism, and particularly what happens between us and Amalek, because otherwise you read a story in which there is a command to destroy everything, and as the text is going to tell us, man and woman, children, animals, and then Shaul is punished for not doing so, although you can't really characterize Shaul's act as an act of mercy, as we'll talk about. But just the whole thing requires discussion and requires some comprehension of what's going on. So last time we did an introduction on war in general in Judaism, and the way that the laws of war are structured to try to avoid the problem of inverted morality, avoiding the problem of people being so focused on destroying, whether destroying life or destroying property, that they lose their ethical focus and their moral focus in general. And so we talked about, and I'm not going to go through it again, the various ways in which halacha tries to combat that. And we also talked specifically about the status of non-combatants. I avoid the phrase collateral damage. It's not that they're people. but that doesn't really solve the Amalek problem, because the laws of war with Amalek don't fit the other wars within Judaism. They don't fit the things that we talked about last time. We talked about leaving room for the enemy to flee so that they'll have an out. That's not there in the war with Amalek, certainly not as presented in the parak that we are about to read. So what I wanted to do is devote some time, and I suspect it's going to be the full time today, but I have available the beginning of parak Ted Vav in the event that we make it there. But what I have is a bit of an introduction, somewhat of an attempt to talk about what happens in the war against Amalek and how it fits into Judaism as a whole. Of course, this week's parsha is Bo, next week's parsha is B'Shalach, so you will also have a wealth of Torah to share for B'Shalach, because the end of B'Shalach records our first encounter with Amalek. So if you take a look on the sheet, source number one is the end of Parshas B'Shalach and the command to engage in war with Amalek. So right away, when you see that it's in the end of B'Shalach, you know that what happened right before it? What's the key event in Parshas B'Shalach? Kriyas Yamsuf, right? We go through the sea, right? This is something that I recommend people do. I've talked about, I don't know if it was here or elsewhere, the idea that you should have certain chapters in Chumash, if not in Tanakh, highlighted, that where key things happen. It can help to orient you as you learn. So, you know, in Chumash, for example, Bereishis Yud Beis, right? Bereishis Yud Bet, for those who prefer, Abram and Sarah arrive in Israel. That's Lech Lecha. That's a good parak to be aware of. Shmos Parak Chaf is. What's in the 20th chapter of Shmos? Aseret HaDibros. Aseret HaDibros. Right. Ten Commandments are in. It's in Parshas Yisro. You are certainly correct. So you know, there are certain prakim that are good to know. Vayikra Yites is another popular one. That's Kedoshim Tiyu. Right.
You did
Aseret
HaDibros.
No, I didn't. I have to go back to the recorder for that one. The same thing is true in Tanakh as a whole. Like when you learn Navi, you can orient yourself also by remembering what's happening in key prakim and in key chapters. So, if not by chapters, at least by parsha, B'Shalach is the Shira, right? That's Az Yashir. And after that, the Jews are out of water, right? And then we get the Be'er Miriam, we get the rock that produces water, and that is followed by this story. So the Jews at this stage are nowhere near their ultimate arrival in Israel. We are literally just days into our experience post-Egypt, right? We went through the Yam Suf on the seventh day of Pesach, right? So we've been out of Egypt for a week, and then you have whatever time it took for Rephidim, right? They went 3 days, they didn't have water, even less than 2 weeks out of Egypt. And along comes Amalek. Vayavo Amalek vayilachem im Yisrael berfidim. Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim, which tells us right off the bat, they hit us. This wasn't the case of us looking for a fight. They attacked us at this place called Rephidim. Ricky.
It's Amalek, Amalhut,
So one of the things that we're going to have, one of the things that we're going to talk about is going to be in the beginning of the chapter, but I'll mention it now, is the geographic location of Amalek.
So
from the way they, yes, from the, I'm getting there. From the way we describe them in the Chumash, it sounds like they are a nomadic tribe that lives in the desert. East of the Yarden. We find them allied with Midian. We find them allied with Moab. They live off to the east, and they're, as I said, nomadic. That's going to be a bit of a problem, because we're going to see them in our Perek in Shmuel, fighting a war with us. We attack them in Israel proper. So one of the things you have to know, where does that map put them? Does it? Doesn't? Okay.
They're wandering still.
Yes. One of the things you have to know when you talk about the various Canaanite tribes, Amalek is not one of them, because again, they're not native to Canaan, but when you talk about those, you see that they have multiple clans within the tribe. So, in other words, the Amori is not one population. There are multiple clans that are called the Amori collectively. That becomes very visible when you deal with the Plishtim, who are not Canaanite either, of course, but the Plishtim are off to the west by the sea, and we are told that they have this Pentapolis going. They got five different cities that that function as a... yeah, I like the word Pentapolis.
I never heard of it.
Yeah, it's a good word. Keep that one. Yeah, it comes up in Yeshaya. But in terms of who Amalek is, that's going to be one of the questions I want to get to when we get to the end of our introduction and into the Perek, is going to be the question of where they are, and the question of are there multiple Amaleks, effectively. And you'll see why I ask that when we get there, but we're not there yet.
He's not part of it, is he?
No, okay. No. Okay, the Amori have their own question, but not for right now. So they attack us in Rephidim. I'm going to stick with the English just for the interest of time. This is the JPS one that they carry on Sepharia. So Moshe says to Yoshua, actually I'm going to just free translate rather than that, because I don't like saying Moses. Moshe went to Yoshua. He says to Yoshua, "B'charlanu anashim, take some men, v'tseihi lachim ba'amalek, and go fight against Amalek." And then this is one of the five sentences which the Gemara says, Gemara Yuma says, cannot really be determined, where there's a word that could go with the previous part of the sentence or with the end of the sentence, the word machar for the Hebrew readers. You could read this as Moshe says to Yoshua, "Choose some men and go fight Amalek tomorrow. I will stand at the top of the hill." Or you could read it as Moshe told Yoshua, "Choose some men and go fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand at the top of the hill." The trop does not lead one way or the other. There's an esnachta, there's a pause on Ba'amalek. The word machar has a revi, which is a standalone note. And then Anochi Nitzav is Mapach Pashta, it starts its own flow. So you could really legitimately read machar either way. It doesn't change anything for us. I just highlight that because of the ambiguity is interesting. But Moshe says to Yoshua, "Pick some men, go fight Amalek today, tomorrow, something. I'm going to go stand at the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." And Yoshua does as Moshe told him, fighting against Amalek. Moshe and Aaron and Hur go up to the top of the hill. We've talked about Hur on other occasions. Hur is a mystery. He is somebody who is put with Aaron in the position of leading the Jews when Moshe goes up on Sinai and then he disappears. But Moshe, Aaron, and Hur are at the top of the hill. Moshe, when he raises his hands, the Jews are victorious, and when he puts his hands down, then Amalek wins, which of course triggers a very interesting question. Then why did you ever put your hands down?
They went up with him so that they would hold his
hands up. That's the next sentence. No. Ruth is talking about the next sentence. Let's just read the next sentence. Moshe's hands were heavy. They took a stone and put it beneath him so that he could sit down at least. And Aaron and Hur are supporting his hands on either side to keep his hands up until the sun goes down. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah talks about what his hands have to do with anything, and the answer is the Jews see his hands raised, they're reminded that they should put their faith in Hashem, and therefore they are victorious. That's the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah talking about the shofar also as something that is inspirational rather than the shofar doing anything on its own. And Yahushua weakens Amalek and his nation by the sword. Hashem says to Moshe, and here's the key in terms of the ongoing war with Amalek, he says, "Ksov zos zikaron basefer." Record this as a memorial in the book. What book? Doesn't say. V'sim be'oznei Yahushua. Put it in Joshua's ears. I am going to eradicate the memory of Amalek from beneath the heavens. And Moshe builds him his Mizbeach, and God declares, or Moshe declares, a hand on the throne of God, war against Amalek from generation to generation. I'm not going to be going into all the nuances of this section. We're not learning Parshas Beshalach right now, and there's an awful lot here to discuss. The purpose of the Mizbeach, naming the Mizbeach, what does that have to do with God's throne? All of these are good questions, but not for right now. What I want to show you here is the concept of eternal war against Amalek, which is not stated for any other enemy in Chumash.
He says he's going to erase the memory.
So it looks, which makes it, that's not really so good if you want it to be an eternal war, because once you erase their memory, no one can remember who they're fighting. Yeah. It's kind of counterintuitive. Yes?
Hashem can destroy them without the help of the army.
Correct.
But why does he not?
Right, so what do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I think that whatever actions we do on this earth are important.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a form of not a test exactly, but a kind of a lesson. But I still think he can just go poof.
He can. So I'll tell you what. Read the next source. Read source number 2 and tell me yourself what the difference is between number 1 and number 2. What's the difference in the in this mitzvah in the second time it shows up at the end of Parshas Ki Tetzeh? This is what we read in the Shabbos before Purim in Shul as Parshas Zachor. What's the key difference between the war against Amalek as it appears in number 1 and the war against Amalek as it appears in the second one?
Second one is it's
attacking.
Jeanette just said it. Timche, you shall destroy.
No.
Yeah. The command is worded in the first one, it's macho emche, I am going to wipe out. In the second one, let's look at it. Hashem says, remember what Amalek did to you on your way out of Egypt. He karcha. Karcha is a funny word. They render it here as surprised you from the word mikra. It just happened. So they read it as they surprised you on the road. We're going to come back to that word at some point. They attacked those who were straggling behind you. You were tired and exhausted, and they did not fear God. That's the simple read of the sentence.
He doesn't fear God.
Right. So again, the simple read of the sentence is Amalek didn't fear God, even though the immediately preceding words described us.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, from a narrative perspective, which is what Pshat looks for, not looks for a story, it doesn't care about the words. The answer is Amalek. Drash looks at it and says, no. That's not the way the wording is in the sentence. The immediate antecedent is about us. And therefore, it's that we didn't fear God, and therefore we were vulnerable to the attack by Amalek. But reading it straight in a straight narrative way, Amalek is the one who is not God-fearing, and they attacked you from behind. And therefore, we get the last sentence here. When God has defeated your enemies around you, when he's given you some space in the land that Hashem is giving you to take, Timche as Zecher Amalek, or Zecher Amalek, you shall be Moche, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven, Lo Tishkach, do not forget. So instead of the way it was in number 1, God has declared eternal war, and God is going to eradicate Amalek. The version here is, you have the job. So to go back to Ricky's question, The goal is not for Amalek to disappear. The goal is for you to make Amalek disappear.
At what cost?
And that's, well, at the cost of their death, apparently. But we haven't gotten to yet the strongest expression of it. The strongest expression is in the parak we have coming up. Take a fast look in your Navi at Shmuel Aleph, Parak Tet Vav, chapter 15, Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. This is what Shmuel says to Shaul. We're going to come back to sentences 1 and 2. I'm not ignoring them. But chapter 15, sentence 3. He says, Ata, and now, Lech mehi kisah es Amalek. You go strike Amalek. V'acharam temes kol asher lo. Destroy or curse, depending on how you take the word cherem, it doesn't matter for our purposes. All that is his. V'lo sach mol alav, show no mercy. Foreshadowing there. V'heim ata, and you shall execute. May ish ad isha, from man to woman. May olel v'ad yonek, two terms that are used to in association with infants. Mishor ve'ad seh, from ox to sheep. Migamal ve'ad chamor, from camel to donkey. All of it. Everything. What Shmuel says, you don't really see, interestingly, in the Psukim and the Chumash. The Chumash just says, eradicate the memory of Amalek, but apparently, this is what that means. Eradicate the memory of Amalek means nothing left. Zero. Now, from a practical perspective, this isn't something that one will end up carrying out. Ever since the days of Sennacherib and the Assyrians, all those populations in the area have been scrambled to the point where even if you are able to identify that's Amalek's location and to find somebody living there, you would not know that that's actually an Amalekite. That's not actually... So it's not something that you're going to practice as a law on the books.
They don't all have red hair.
David had red hair. So the question, though, is still, what do you do with this? Because this is fundamental to Judaism. You don't. I sent out an email last year. I think it was last year or the year before, from the weekly emails of my Beit Midrash, talking about Amos Oz and his concept of the cellar. Amos Oz talks about how all of Torah is our inheritance. It's all ours, and it shapes us, and it's part of us, and so on. However, he says, sometimes a person inherits something, and they don't really want it on display. And they just put it sort of in a dark part of the basement, like, because you have to have it, because it's offensive if you don't keep it around, but you don't actually want everybody to see it, so you don't want to deal with it, so you just kind of bury it. And he says that Jews do this with parts of Judaism that disturb them. It's their inheritance. They're not getting rid of it, but they just keep it in an area where they don't have to think about it. I thought it was very sharp as an analogy. But is that what we do? Like, is that what we're going to do? What am I like? We'll just sort of say, look, Judaism is beautiful. Yeah, there was an essay where Rabbi Strauchler, Shai Shemayim, sent out a link to, it wasn't an essay originally, it was a speech. It was Barry Weiss, who's a columnist. She spoke at the rally against anti-Semitism in New York. So he sent a link to the transcript of it. It's a beautiful speech. Yeah, all about the things that make her Jewish and that she's proud of and all that. And yeah, there are certain things that aren't in that speech. Like, so what do you do with those? What do you do with this issue? So what I want to do is talk about why Amalek is such an enemy using three different approaches that we find within Chazal, within our sages. One approach is the simplest, and that is to say it's their personal character. They identify in Tanakh as a very cruel nation. It was highlighted, right, when they attacked us here, when they came at us in the desert. We were a threat to no one, and they attacked the stragglers and the weak. They, what'd you do that for? And Abarbanel and Malbim play up what they think of as that aspect of Amalek. And it also comes up later on in when David and his men are living in a town called Ziklag, This is before David actually takes the throne. And they leave the town of Ziklag. They're going off on a raid somewhere. And they come back to find that the town has been raided by Amalek and has been destroyed, and the women have been taken as captives. And it just highlights the cruelty of Amalek.
This is the same Amalek that Shaul was
destroyed. How could
that's what, yeah, you missed that in the first
how
part.
How could that happen?
Yes.
Had he destroyed them, they wouldn't have destroyed
that's
them.
That's not necessarily. We're coming back to that. No. Yes.
How could they revive straight away? Because didn't take everybody except
the great question. I'm just not ready for it yet. We're coming to it. We are coming to it. It goes back to where Diane was just going. It goes back to the discussion that I mentioned with Ricky before about where they live. We have to deal with that question. But the weakness in this answer is, number one, they do have a reason to hate us. It's not an out-of-nowhere thing, as we're going to see. Amalek has a reason. There is an issue between Amalek and us before we ever entered the Midbar, believe it or not. That's number one. Number two...
They weren't around
either. Hang on. Number two, the seven nations are also bad. The seven nations are also cruel and abusive. What do we know about places like Shechem and Sodom? What do we know about Egypt? I mean, to just single them out because they attacked us from behind once? I mean, I'm sorry, we had worse things happen to us by other nations. We know that it's very odd. You know, you had Nachash of Ammon who said to the people of Yavesh Gilad that, sure, I'll make a treaty and keep you safe as long as you all knock out your right eye. Oh, we're good with that. He doesn't deserve to be destroyed. Like, why just Amalek? This is difficult. The second approach is the relationship that they have with God. And this is, of the three, this is the one that has the greatest justification in the text regarding their original attack. Right? If you go back to source number one, God makes it a personal vendetta. Right? God says, I am going to eradicate the memorial of Amalek. It's a personal war. Moshe swears by the throne of God to pursue this war. It's not about us. It's about God. And so too, in number two, we said, Velo Yare Elokim is read as a description of Amalek, that Amalek lacked Yirat Elokim. They are the ones who are not in awe of God. Also, in that same section, in number two, we are told to wipe them out mitachat hashamayim, from under the heavens, suggesting that there's some kind of connection to God here. It doesn't say wipe them from on the earth. It says wipe them off from under the heavens.
So much more reason for Hashem to do that himself.
Understood. As a result of this perspective that it's between them and God, the commentators read various philosophical sins into their identity. So take a look at source number three, Ibn Ezra, on the account that's in Beshalach. He says, Ba'avur sheikh is as Hashem, because he, Amalek, angered God. Kielufei Edom nivhalo mipachdo, because the leaders of Edom were all afraid of God at that point. He's borrowing language from Azyashir. Bavur ha'osos sha'asa b'mitzrayim u'bayam, because of the wonders that God performed in Egypt and at the sea. V'kacha Moab u'pleshes, and Moab is afraid, and the Plishtim are afraid. V'hine ze'a Amalek shama gvuras Hashem bavur amo Yisrael. Amalek heard of what God did for the Jews. V'hine b'mimakom racho. He came from far away to attack us. He doesn't live down by Egypt. Velo pachad me Hashem. And he didn't fear God. So Ibn Ezra, reading this on a pshat level, this doesn't require any level of inference here. You just look at the story. We just came out of the sea. Everybody else is scared. And Amalek, who doesn't live there, decides that they're going to come attack us. So Ibn Ezra, as far as he's concerned, says that they are such a repellent nation in terms of their relationship with God. The commentators go further with this, seeing this unprovoked attack as a sign of their religious identity. So Rav Moshe Sternbach in his Chubos Ve'Anhagos says something that others do as well. In the original shiur where I quoted this, I didn't bring the Hebrew, and I didn't stick it back in here. I felt like, you know, we had a lot on the page anyway. But I brought you my translation. He says, the main impurity of Amalek is karcha baderech. They happened upon you, right? What the JPS read as they surprised you. But he's reading, as many do, karcha as mikra. Mikra meaning happenstance, to say that everything that happens is just happenstance. Everything is happenstance. God isn't running the world. That even after the open miracles and wonders of the Exodus from Egypt, they came as sorcerers, claiming that all was a lie and happenstance. So those who will make that statement that God is not actually running the show, that's Amalek. Rav Kook also has an element of this in source number 5. In his commentary on the Gemara in Brachos, he says, Amalek opposes the existence of a nation which governs itself by God's words. So that even though we weren't a danger to them at this stage, they attacked us. Look at number 5. Amalek nitzav kitzar li Yisrael. Amalek stands as a foe of Israel. Eino ha'isara abba meshayatsu Yisrael ha'chadesh ba'olam. Their eye was tsar. Their eye, I had to think about how to translate that, but I chose his eye was evil. He had the evil eye, so to speak, against that which Israel had emerged to create. Shetia uma misnaheges b'malchusal pi ga'on shem Hashem. For a nation to run its affairs by the power of the name of God. Even if we weren't trying to rule over everybody else. He says, the whole mission that we have is for there to be a nation in this world which runs its life around Hashem, around
that's
the
really
relationship
good.
With Hashem.
That's really good, I like that.
Okay. Alkein Amalekim hamisnaged lazeus ifav yiyu eder aved. And therefore Amalek is doomed to be a lost flock. Eder aved could mean lost or could mean destroyed. Aved with an aleph.
Unfortunately, Rav Kook didn't live till the Holocaust.
So the idea that he presents here is that there is sort of a yin-yang balance between the Jews and Amalek, in which we are the nation that wants to run itself by God, and Amalek is the one who is opposed to that ideal.
They're afraid of
it. He's going to come back to that later on. Yeah. He's going to come back to that later on. Actually, no, he's going to come back to that now. Just kidding. Take a look at source number 6. Yes, Sandy.
Eradicating the children of Israel, he's therefore eradicating any proof of what was supposedly happening in Egypt.
That would go along with this, yes.
Yeah. But I want to ask you then, we didn't have internet and airplanes and Morse code in those days. How much time had passed for everybody, all the nations, Philistine, Israel?
Right, so the Torah takes it as a given that everybody in the region is aware. It's not, these nations there are not that far apart. I mean, you can go from Egypt into Israel, depending on which way you do your crossing, you know, relatively quickly, as we're told in the beginning of Parshas Beshalach. So it's not bizarre, you know, when something like this happens, that everybody would find out. There are also the Midrashim that built on certain references in the text to say things like all the water split. It wasn't just Yam Suf that was splitting, things like that.
Although it says that they came from far away. So, I mean, you know, there wasn't social media then.
Far away means in the desert.
Depends how far.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in the desert, they...
Relatively far.
It
means they weren't on the line of fire.
Yeah, they weren't. And they also might be too far to have heard what happened.
Mm-hmm. So, that's not the assumption, though. Yeah.
They probably could see the darkness from far. You could see that this area is just like there's something going on there.
That I don't know. I don't know how it was manifest. But Rav Kook sees a need to have this duality of Israel and Amalek. And he ties it into Moshe's hands being heavy. And I asked the question, why did you just keep your hands up, right? So he says, no. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom ba'atzmo lo haya efshir lo la'asos ha'melchama ba'amalek. He says, Moshe can't fight the war against Amalek. Amalek shu sitnam shal Yisrael u'menagdam. Amalek who is the satan, the obstruction for Israel and their opponent. La'ayin atzofia adzof kol hadorot. To the eye that sees, to the end of all generations, meaning Moshe. Ka'adon ha'neviim. Right, the chief prophet, Asher Bechol Beisi Ne'eman, who he is, the one who is described as the loyal one in God's whole house. Who ro'esh she'od yesh tzarech gam ba'amalek? He understands Amalek's time to be destroyed has not yet come. There's a need for Amalek at this stage. Ki od lo nitaru Yisrael legamri ad shelo yeh tzarech la'olam b'kach ha'menageit lahem. We had not reached the point where there was no need for a balance. At this stage, we had not yet reached our potential, and therefore there had to be the opponent against whom we would reach that potential. This is very Rav Kook. Al kein yidei Moshe kvedim. Therefore, Moshe's hands were heavy. Ubekocho ha'atzmi haya kemuchrach lahorid l'niach yadav. The Torah says kvedim. They go back to the first side. You'll see it there. So the Moshe had to put his hands down. He couldn't maintain this this fight with Amalek. This is very Rav Kook. Rav Kook is very into a mystical idea, which is found in the Maharal, and it's found in a whole school of thought, that says everything in this world has a purpose. And that includes all the horrible things you can name. Everything that exists, by definition, if it exists, has to have something to contribute to the universe, and there's the notion of there being good and there being bad and there being a balance to it. There's a lot to be said for this and about this in the thought of Rav Kook that's not for this session in particular, but that's the way he perceives Amalek. Amalek is the counterbalance.
This is so depressing.
Yeah, isn't
it? This is so depressing.
I'm sorry.
Life.
I didn't warn you.
It's never going to end.
Well, no.
We
just have to get there.
We know it'll end. The manifestation of true basic hatred, pure anti-Semitism that exists. He's a symbol of that. It's the manifestation of that.
He's not the only one.
Be door to door, and yes, maybe we're being punished because we're not pious enough, but I think they really are pure evil that exists in the world. I think that.
Well, we ain't done yet.
Yeah, but he says it right in the beginning in Shemot that the Hashem will be at war with.
Yes. Now the thing is, if we don't have an Amalek around anymore, then maybe that means we've perfected ourselves. We're going to get to the question of Amalek today. But let's go a little further here because we have so much to see, and we're already 32 minutes in. So this idea that Amalek is opposed to God is one of the answers that Abarbanel and Malbim ultimately suggest, meaning they begin by saying that it must be their personal character because there's no other reason for them to attack us. And then they offer two explanations, one of which is what we're saying now, which is it's really about God. That's what drives them. The weakness in this explanation about Amalek is that, again, the Canaanites in general had terrible relationships with God. We've talked about that, right? We talked about the Jews having a mission when they come into the land to fight against them. We were supposed to convert them to be Geri Toshav, to follow the Noahide laws, and that didn't succeed. And therefore, we ended up having to fight wars with them. These were people who were committed to Avodah Zarah, to idolatry. I don't understand why they don't then have this type of a war. And maybe you could answer, well, they didn't attack us first. Right, Amalek attacks us without being threatened. Canaan, at least, was threatened by us. Right, that we knew.
Do we know if Amalek had idols as God? Because even the thought of an idol as God shows that they still pray.
So that's an interesting question.
Greater being or something,
right.
And they just maybe aren't sophisticated
Right. The commentators who seize on this idea of mikra, of happenstance, suggest that Amalek does not want any gods.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
Eddie.
You're saying, though, before you said that Amalek had the reason to be to hate us.
Right. So our first reason that we're giving them is their animosity towards God. And the second one is coming. It's the animosity towards us. But that's where I'm going now. The third approach, the third approach that I would offer is that it's, in fact, their hatred for us. You don't see it in the account in Bishalach. They just happen to be there. Right? That's what the text said. You don't see it in Kitetse either. It sort of is hinted by describing how they are cruel, they attack from behind, but it doesn't really tell us about it. What does tell us more about it is source number 7. Take a look at source number 7. This is what happens afterward. So we get attacked in Bamidbar chapter 14 by Amaleki and Kinaani. In Shoftim, we are attacked by Amalek along with Moab. Again in Shoftim, we are attacked by Amalek, this time working with Midian. Then you get our story in Shmuel, in which Shaul attacks them and has mercy on Agag the king. Then, 12 chapters afterwards, we get David attacking Amalek, not as a Jew. David attacks Amalek on behalf of the Plishtim. This is when David is on the run from Shaul and the Plishtim take him in. So he actually is attacking them on behalf of the Plishtim, the Philistines. And then you get the attack by Amalek burning down the city of Ziklag and kidnapping the women and children. That's the attack that a few people have now asked about. If only Agag was left, how did that happen? We have to talk about that. I'm not done with that one. And then in the beginning of Shmuel Bat, we find that an Amaleki kills or reports having killed Shaul HaMelech, because you remember that Shaul dies in the war with the Plishtim. We thought he died by his own hand. But the Amaleki claims to have murdered Shaul. And then, one last one, in Divrei HaYamim, Shimon, the tribe of Shimon, of all people, goes to war against them later in the first temple, in the first Beis HaMikdash. So it's not as though the story of our relationship with Amalek is a one-shot. They attacked us in the wilderness, and now hatred forever. You have a series of attacks, and Chachamim, our sages, looked at it and said it goes back to their genealogical roots. Not only to their roots, but to their roots on both sides. It's the roots on both sides, the father's side and the mother's side. The father's side is in source number 8. V'simna ha'isafi legesh la'alifaz ben Esav. We meet a woman by the name of Timna. We're going to have to talk about her more in a moment. But she was a concubine of Eliphaz, who was son of Esav. Not only is he the son of Esav, he's the firstborn of Esav. V'tel la'alifaz es Amalek. And Timna, correct? Timna births Amalek. So Amalek is the grandson of Esav, who wanted to kill Yaakov. Right? This is a part of that ancient enmity. There's this midrash about how it is that Yaakov ended up with nothing when he crossed the Yarden. Right? That Esav had sent Eliphaz after him. Eliphaz was supposed to kill him, but Eliphaz didn't want to kill him because he knew Yaakov. Yaakov had raised him. And so he said, look, if I just take his property, then this is though he's dead. That highlights this idea of an enmity that crosses the generations, or attempts to cross the generations. And it also develops in Midrashim, which identify the roots of Amalek's hatred for the Jews coming from a conversation with Esav about the Jews. That's on the father's side. Then the mother's side, Timna. It's really odd that Timna is identified as she is in the Chumash. This Gemara that speaks about it talks about Timna, and specifically the fact that she's identified. It's the pasuk before number 8, Vachot Lotan Timna. The sister of Lotan was Timna, and that's really odd. Because Lotan...
The daughter of Lotan.
Oh, that's really funny. No, it's a mistake. It's a sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's just my mistake in translating too quickly.
Is Lotan a guy?
Lotan is very much a guy. Lotan is a clan leader. Aluf Lotan, Aluf Timna. And here is the problem that the Gemara is struggling with. She is the sister of a clan leader, right? She herself, it says, Aluf Timna.
Israelite clan.
No, not Jewish.
Oh.
These are from Edom.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that we have is, how is it that a clan leader, someone who is royalty, ends up being a concubine? That doesn't make any sense. The concubine was somebody who was of a lower status.
Hagar.
Yeah, exactly like Hagar. That's a problem also. Same problem, except that Hagar doesn't end up being a concubine. She ends up being Ishto. She ends up being the wife of Avraham. But the fact that she was a maid first, right, is, and the Medrash discusses that. So what the Gemara assumes is, the only way this makes sense, that a clan leader would have agreed to be a Pelegesh, must be because she wanted desperately to be a part of this family. The other suggestion would have been military conquest, obviously, but that's not the way the Gemara goes with it. Take a look at source number 9, a very important passage here. Hang on, Ricky, just first see source number 9. Achot Lotan Timna, the sister of Lotan was Timna. Maihi, who was she? Timna bas malachim havoi, she's a daughter of kings. Dichsiv aluf Lotan, aluf Timna. Right? Aluf Aval, if you say so, and so on. These are alufim. What is an aluf? V'chol aluf malchusa v'lo tagahi. Aluf is, as I translated it here, an uncrowned empire. Meaning they weren't kings themselves, but they had people who answered to them. They're the heads of clans. Sorry. Yeah.
Tribal.
Yeah. Baya liigure. She wanted to convert. Basa etel Avram Yitzchak v'Yaakov v'lo kiblua. She comes to Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov, and they're not interested. So she went to become a Pelegesh for Eliphaz. Amra, she said, I'd rather be a maid for this nation than to be a matron in another one. Nafak mina Amalek titzarina li Yisrael. You turn somebody away, you see what happens. Amalek emerges from her, which causes such pain to us. My time, why? The lo ibaya lahu l'rochaka, because they should not have distanced her. So this is the second. Doesn't say, but this is a polemic. This piece in the Gemara is a polemic against those who are too demanding when somebody, you know, is sincere. That's the issue. So, Ricky, what were you going to ask?
It's okay. I was just a little discombobulated, but I'll take your word.
Okay. I'm glad.
Thanks.
Yes, Ethi.
It says that she asked Abraham, Isaac, and Yaakov to become Jewish.
Yeah.
She's like a granddaughter of Esav.
No, she married the grandson. She married the grandson after.
Okay, so there's many generations after Abraham and Yitzchak.
Right, so I don't look at... First of all, keep in mind, Abraham is around until Yaakov and Esav are 15 years old. It's, yeah, so that's, you know, it's not unheard of. She should, if she's, let's say, their age... Right, and she first comes to old Abraham, and Abraham says no, and then she goes to Yitzchak and says no, and she goes to Yaakov and says no. You can have that happen, but I don't look at this as literal. She went to all three of them, and you know each one said no.
Why would they have said no?
We don't know. But as I said, it's a polemic against refusing people who are sincere. That's what this is about. It's going to come back to bite you.
Right? It's not written anywhere.
What does that mean? It's written here.
No,
what the Gemara is doing here is building a case on scriptural evidence. Meaning the evidence of the text is, number one, she was royalty. Sorry, I want to say this in a way that everybody hears it, because this is important. Number one, she was royalty. Number two, she ended up being a concubine. And number three, we see that her descendants hate us without any cause. So, putting those pieces together, the Gemara says, it's got to be that somehow these details are enough for us to reconstruct what was going on. Those three pieces of information have to be enough for us to work with. And so the answer is, the animosity towards us, the hatred towards us, figured into how she went from being a queen to being a concubine. And that's what the Medrash here is doing. But moving ahead in history, because we ain't done, take a look at number 10. Aluf Magdiel, Aluf Iram, Ela Alufei Edom. We find out that that Aluf Magdiel, ends up being, well, oh, I didn't bring you the Rashi. Oh well, but Rashi's commenting on this says that Aluf Magdiel is Rome. And also has animosity towards us, meaning the descendants of Esav continue their animosity towards us. It's not something that just starts there. It's something that continues.
Are they all the Christians?
So that's where the church begins. It's supposed to be from them. So what this means is that Amalek is viewed as an ongoing rodef. They're viewed as hating us in an ongoing way. And this fits in with the Kuzari's idea of traits that cross generations and that are, in fact, inherited somehow just as part of your identity. Whether you take it as education or whether you take it as built in, that's a separate discussion. But because of that, the response is, we better do something about it. Take a look at Ralbag in source number 11. Ralbag says, Ra'oi la'adam, k'shiyipol bi'ado b'milchama, mishu tamid lo ul'amo l'kot machiv. He says, it's appropriate if, in the course of a war, somebody falls to you, and it's somebody who had always been a thorn in your side, shalo yachmol alav, don't have mercy on him. Ach yiva eros omen ha'aretz, get rid of him. Pen yimtzalo makom achar zeh, yimalei lashchiz hu ve'amo l'fi ha'yecholes. Because otherwise, you run the risk that he finds another opportunity to attack you. The Ralbag says, if you spare him, he's not going to be grateful. Yeah.
But God spares Ishmael in the desert. Because the whole argument is that he's, and the Midrash tells you, the angels say don't do it because he's going to cause a lot of trouble later, and God says he didn't do it yet, but we know he's going to do it. God knows.
What's the difference between the two stories?
He hasn't done anything yet, but we know he's going to do something.
One difference is that Yishmael at that stage has apparently repented of whatever he was doing before, and he's not a threat at that moment, but the other difference is that that's God.
He gets off.
Yes, God can make a decision and say, I looked into the future and I saw where he's going, but right now he doesn't deserve this. Human beings don't work that way. If you have somebody who attacks you and who says, I want to wipe you out, right, like the line goes, believe them. That's Ralbag's line, and it leads to the line from Radak. This is a famous one in number 12. V'achemla al harishayim achzariyut. Mercy on the wicked is cruelty. You know they're going to fight you in the end. And so you flip the page and you see this line which Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik gets credited with, but it's his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who seems to be the source. If any people seeks to destroy us, we are commanded to do battle against it when it rises up against us. And this battle of ours is an obligatory war. On the basis of the verse from Exodus, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. If somebody is going to attack us, you have to fight back. They have the status of a rodef, a pursuer. Now, the truth of the matter is, you have in halacha a debate about safek rodef. What do you do if you're not sure whether someone would attack you? How sure do you have to be? There's a lot of discussion about this in halacha. I've given shiurim on it elsewhere, but it's not for right now. What I do want to show you here is the Avnei Nezer of Avram Bornstein in source number 14, who says this case is not safek. This case is not doubt. By virtue of the fact that God tells you to fight them a war across time against them, he's telling you that there is no doubt. God can say things like that. He says, "Dishanya zayin umos shachotim ba'atzman va'osim kol ha'tovos v'nechayvu misa." He says, the seven nations are treated differently from the way we treat Amalek. The seven nations, we see, they sin, they do things that are bad, and they ultimately perform acts that warrant a capital punishment. But Amalek is different. They're being punished because of a war that happened in Parshas Beshalach. Doesn't the Torah say we don't kill children for the sins of their parents? So how is it that Amalek gets this? It doesn't make any sense. Ach The answer is he plays the God card. He says, because God knows that the enmity is still in their hearts. Look at what happens with Haman, who is described as being from Agag. We have to talk about that. When children emulate the sins of the parents, then we are taught that there can be such a punishment. So that's your third explanation, right? Your first explanation, the one that we threw in there initially, was that it's their personal character. The fact that they would attack you from behind in that way, they're such a cruel people. They attacked us without reason. However, then we saw that they actually have two reasons. Right? The second approach was to say that it's their animosity towards God. That's what this is all about. It's what drove their attack, and it's what drives our response. And that's one reason of theirs for attacking us, was because they didn't want what we represented. And then the third approach is that it's about their hatred for us, a hatred which goes back to Esav. On their father's side, Esav; on their mother's side, Timnah, because she was rejected. And the hatred of Esav is, of course, because of his relationship with Yaakov, and Yaakov got the bracha, and that whole initial point. But those are your three explanations. But here I want to show you something that a lot of people are not familiar with. And it's something that people should be familiar with. Take a look, please, at the Rambam, which I brought you in source number 15. Says the Rambam, Shiva Amin va'amalek shelo hishlimu ein manich in mehem neshama. He says, these seven nations, as well as Amalek, if they don't make peace with you, you don't leave anyone alive. Right? That, we knew about the don't leave anyone alive thing. We've discussed that. But they, did you notice what would happen if they did make peace? You can keep them alive. What happened to war to the death? Right? Eradicate their property. Men, women, children, and so on. The Rambam seems to be ignoring that and suggesting that actually a treaty with Amalek is possible. The Ravid was bothered by that. Take a look at the Ravid and his comment, which I brought you also in number 15. Amar Avram ze shibush. He says, that's just wrong. Ella but sheyachol lomar hishlimu lekabel hamitzvos. He says, what they could do is accept the mitzvos. Meaning, if they keep mitzvos, then that's a different story. And there's much on this, right? But does he mean seven mitzvos? Does he mean conversion? That's a discussion. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, has more on this in a tshuva, for those who want to look it up. It's Yud Gimel Ayin Aleph. But conversion does seem possible. Number 16, a classic. Mibnei banav shel Haman lamdu or limdu Torah bivnei brak. The Gemara says it's part of a discussion of how the descendants of horrible people went and improved their lot. So it says here that Haman has grandchildren who either learned or taught, it's unclear, Torah in bnei brak. We assume that means they converted to Judaism. There was a Beis Din somewhere that said, oh, let's learn more about you. Where do you come from? I'd rather not talk about that. Well, sorry, we have a form here. We need the names of your grandparents. Grandfather. Haman. I knew a Haman. Is that a question? Yeah, sorry.
The name Rep was already in existence, or is it many generations?
Well, yeah, grandchildren doesn't have to mean literally, right. You know, two generations. Yeah. Correct. It's a very interesting idea. Rav Kook explains this as well. This possibility. Hang on. Because who says they were destroyed? We know that he is killed and his sons are killed. Number one, there could be daughters. But number two, maybe they had children before that. We don't know. But take a look at source number 17, please, from Rav Kook. Because Rav Kook entertains this idea on a spiritual level. Look at this. I love what he does with this. He says, first of all, I'm going to just stick with my English translation because we're running low on time. He says, the trait of love which resides in the souls of the righteous includes all creations, and does not exclude anything, any nation or tongue. Even Amalek is only eradicated from beneath the heavens, but via purification it is elevated to a good root which is above the heavens. And all of it is included in the higher love, but it needs a great force and mighty purity for this lofty unification. I don't know what all of that means. Maybe some of this is Rav Kook's mysticism. But the message that he's giving you is very clear. Right? The message he's giving you is that redemption is possible. In number 18 also, he talks about this in the context of the idea that his grandchildren taught or learned Torah in Bnei Brak. Right? He says, look at that. That shows chesed. My favorite is what he does in number 19. And this comes back to our big question. We are troubled. There's no way around it by this war. And we're going to continue to be troubled because we're going to read about it. And it's going to say, everybody, man, woman, child. And you can't, the ramifications of that, the idea that, you know, this isn't just a hypothetical story. Like, there are real human beings who are being told to wipe out everybody. It's really, really difficult. So, regardless of the justification. But I like what Rav Kook does in number 19, in which he says that it can't really be an act of destruction. You can't get caught up in the enmity of it. Part of that was seen already in 18, but look what he does in 19. He says, he refers you to the laws of Shabbos. You know that we have 39 malachos, 39 categories of creative behavior, which we're not allowed to engage in on Shabbos. These were the acts that were involved in the creation of the Mishkan. Right, creation slash maintenance, stone discussion. But they're all creative acts. If you take that which is a creative act and you perform it in a destructive way, it's not a malacha. You're still not supposed to do it. It's still prohibited, but not on the same level. So, for example, if a person lights a fire in order to produce... Well, I don't want to... All right, I'll give you the classic example. A person digs a hole, right? They dug holes in the Mishkan in order to... Either you could say store something in the hole, right? Or in order to put like a tent peg into the hole. But you were using the hole itself. That was your constructive act in digging a hole. What if, on the other hand, you dug a hole for some destructive reason? The hole digging thing lends itself to all sorts of different permutations I'm not dealing with. But let's say you dug it as a destructive thing. You wanted to destroy something. So you want to undermine it, and therefore you dig a hole in a destructive way. That's not the malacha. So take a look at number 19. He says, you're still not allowed to do it, but it's not the original biblical prohibition. So he says, so we have learned in the laws of Shabbos. Erasure in general, we talk about erasing Amalek. Erasure in general is destructive. And erasure is not considered malacha unless one erases in order to write. Right? If you erase a surface that you can write on it, that's constructive. For only then is it an action with the goal of repair. From here, repair, improvement, however you want to call that. From here one may learn for the mitzvah of eradicating Amalek. One should not think that this is a mitzvah of simple eradication, a mitzvah of erasure, and nothing more. For it has been said, that would be destructive. Since the goal of Amalek was to strike the nation which carried the name of God in the world, the nation with whom God struck a covenant, which is the throne of God in the world, therefore the mitzvah of eradicating Amalek is erasure, which is in order to write, in order to prepare the world in the empire of God. He says it has to be constructive. It can't just be, I want to destroy. If it's just destruction, that's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah has to be fundamentally constructive. My last word on this is from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And this is a well-known essay of his called Developing a Torah Personality. And he talks about the challenge of dealing with this mitzvah of destroying Amalek so completely. And he also talks about how he deals with it. If you check out that link, you'll see how he deals with it. But he writes, what makes this problem more acute is the fact that it arises particularly in individuals who are morally and spiritually sensitive. Those who are relatively coarse are not concerned with these issues. Who is troubled by the command to wipe out Amalek? Those people who have succeeded in developing the kind of moral sensitivity that is important to us. In other words, if you're not disturbed, you're doing it wrong. That's what he's trying to say. A Jew who's doing it right is going to be bothered by this. He goes on, as I said, to discuss it. He talks about the role models he had, who were incredibly sensitive and concerned, who would go out in the middle of the night to check their step to see if a baby might have been left there, because they were known as kind people who would do that sort of thing, and therefore, in fact, women who couldn't manage their child would, in fact, leave the child for them. People like that. And he says they were able to deal with this mitzvah of Amalek somehow, and that gave him some ability to look at it himself. Look at the essay. It's better than the rush that I'm giving to it. But as I said an hour ago, I'm not doing away with the problems of this mitzvah. It is fundamentally a problem. But what I'm trying to do is show where it fits within Judaism, the idea of where their hatred comes from, what it represents for us, as well as to show you from that Rambam that even here there is some possibility of redemption. So what we're going to do next week, God willing, is start on this the actual story of Shaul and the war with Amalek. At some point, probably in the next few weeks of dealing with this, people are going to, once again, maybe some who weren't here today, or just because this happens, people are going to say, well, how could you be commanded to do this to Amalek? And I'm just going to say, listen to the audio from this class. I'm not re-litigating this. Thank you very much.